All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a very special program for you today. At the back end, you'll be hearing from Deborah Sweet reporting on the demonstration in Washington against the Guantanamo prison chamber. But for the vast majority of the program, we have a very special segment. A little while ago, I had the opportunity and the privilege to do an interview with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the leader of a whole new stage of communist revolution in the world. And in this interview, Avakian makes a very powerful argument why nothing short of revolution will deal with the howling problems in the world today. Avakian provides a deep analysis on the recent elections, as well as the illusion behind elections under this system in general. And he speaks to the lies told about the history of communism, the real potential for revolution in this country, and the strategy for that revolution, what the goal of this revolution is, and in particular, what the breakthroughs are that are concentrated in the new synthesis of communism that BA has developed. And Avakian also talks with great passion and science about what's kept him on the revolutionary road for decades now, despite great sacrifice and a great personal risk. So don't forget, this interview is going to start today and go for the next 4 weeks, all right? 4 weeks after today. So right now, pull yourselves up real close to the radio. Stop your car, pull over to the side of the road, stop what you're doing to listen to this interview. I guarantee you, you haven't heard anything like this before. All right, well, first, let me welcome you back to the show.
it's good to be back.
Yeah. And great to have you, and great to have you in times like this, where we're actually faced with some pretty major questions in a pretty horrible world and a situation that is just, it's relentless, you know, and you look at what's going on in the world. And I know things that you said, both in the interview you recently did with Cornel West and in the interview you did with A. Brooks, you know, you talked about the situation in the world, the horror that the world is, and also the fact that there's just not a response that's commensurate with that horror. And I kept thinking, as I was looking at all this, I kept thinking about something you raised a number of years ago, and you brought from Marx, the point about the heaviest weight on people was actually the fact that this belief that the conditions that they were living in were a permanent necessity. And it really limited people in terms of their vision, their aspirations, their understanding of things. And you can see this today in a lot of ways. I mean, people just, they really are in this box that's very well defined. And I wanted to ask you if you could talk about that some, this question of permanent necessity of the conditions that exist and how there is no permanent necessity, but we're up against a situation where people are really, as I said, really, really pounded down by that. And it is so limiting. And I wanted to talk about what you think around that, the material basis for that, the consequences of it. And then maybe later, you know, as you go on, how the hell we can break through on that?
Well, I think this affects different sections of people differently. Among, you know, the people on the bottom of the society, the people who, as you know, we say, taking from Malcolm X, you know, are the ones who catch hell the hardest ways every day under the system. The weight of the system on them, on their backs, on their necks, you know, and the difficulty of just being able to get through the day with that, just being able to live, not being evicted from the housing project or, you know, the other dwelling you're in, you know, not being made homeless, you know, not having your son killed by the police, you know, or brutalized and humiliated by the police, at least, you know, all these kind of things are the kind of things that weigh on people. And I think there's a tendency for people in that situation to see their individual conditions as a result of individual, of their own individual fate, their own individual situation, and not to see it as flowing from a whole system. And so all that weighs on people in one sense, in one way, that people feel that they can't even hardly deal with the daily difficulties and the horrors of daily life, which often are genuinely horrible. And, you know, the idea that the whole society could be changed is something, when you're in that kind of situation, is spontaneously and on your own, is very difficult to even conceive of or to even engage or to take up. I think among more, you know, middle class sections of society, people who are more formally educated, you know, I think there's been a whole weight since the 1960s, and in particular since the defeat of socialism in China and the reversal there with the coup d'etat shortly after Mao died, when a lot of people in that time in the 60s and early 70s were looking to China and the Cultural Revolution as an example of how the world could be radically different, and we're inspired by that. But since that time, there's not only has there been the practical defeat of that and the people like Deng Xiaoping coming to power, and then the people who followed his whole program remaining in power in China with all the terrible consequences, as a matter of fact, for the great majority of people in China. But there's been a relentless ideological assault coming from the rulers of this country and from their, you know, counterparts in other countries, the people who preside over the system of imperialism, for short, a relentless assault ideologically against the whole idea of communism, against what went on in China, against the Cultural Revolution, against Mao, book after book after book, slandering and distorting what happened there. You can't even hardly keep up with the books that they keep churning out. I mean, if you want to write, if you want to get a book published, let me give some advice to people. You want to get a book published, write a book slandering Mao, China, communism, the Cultural Revolution. You'll have a good chance of getting it published, even if it's the most shoddy scholarship that anybody could possibly imagine. Well, that weighs on, you know, the people at the base of society that I was talking about a little while ago. You know, it filters down to them, so to speak, even if they don't read those books directly because they don't have time and don't have the opportunity and haven't had the training, etc. But it weighs directly and heavily on people in the middle class and the intelligentsia who have been, you know, worn down. Many people who once knew better, you know, have been worn down by all this, and they've started to rethink their assumptions, lower their sights, lower even their dreams, and start to think, well, maybe, you know, if people, for example, of my generation who came through the 60s, who were inspired by communism, by the Cultural Revolution, by what was represented by Mao and China and so on, have come to think, well, maybe we were wrong. Maybe that really was terrible. Maybe the best it is possible to have is some variation of the system we have now, you know, the capitalist system, but let's call it democracy because that sounds better. And, you know, maybe all we can do is tinker around the edges of this system and try to maybe deal with, you know, mitigating, you know, some of the worst excesses of the system, but any kind of radical alternative is not really possible. So I think this has been a tremendous weight on people in different ways among different sections of the population. And actually what Marx was getting at was when this kind of belief that's been reinforced in people in the permanent necessity of existing conditions, in the idea that there is no better alternative and that any attempt at an better alternative has either been drowned in blood, crushed, and or has been a nightmare and even worse than what we have now. When that kind of belief begins to break down, that then this liberates people to struggle for all kinds of things. I mean, he made the point that this will break down in people's understanding even before it's actually overturned and defeated in the realm of practical struggle. So the struggle to raise people's sights back up, to recognize the horrific character of the system we have now, and to recognize that there have been breakthroughs, emancipating breakthroughs and bringing a radical alternative into being through the Communist Revolution in the Soviet Union and to even greater heights in China and through the Cultural Revolution is a very important thing, at the same time as it's very important that people, as we say, fight the power, that they rise up and resist the crimes of the system and the way that they're oppressed under and exploited under and degraded under it, whether it's women who are, you know, raped and beaten in the millions every year in this country and degraded and demeaned through things like pornography, and which has become increasingly violent and vicious at the same time it's become increasingly mainstreamed in this culture. You know, the more that people learn about what is actually going on in the world, for example, the fact that 10 million children die every year of preventable disease, starvation and malnutrition, 10 million children, more than the population of New York City. And as I pointed out, this is owing to the workings of this system. So, you know, the way that imperialist capitalism has penetrated into the economies of all these countries in the third world has further driven people who were barely hanging on, for example, out of the countryside, no longer able to make even a meager living farming. They, you know, they go into the urban shanty towns where there are terrible conditions, no decent health care, no decent conditions, literally children playing amidst garbage and human waste, tens and tens of millions of people in these urban slums throughout the third world. And, you know, I made the point that this is owing to the workings of this system. And if people, if the ruling class of this system, the people who are sitting atop the government of the U.S. most of all, were to actually take these 10 million children and shoot them down one by one every year, everybody would recognize what a horrific system it is. And anybody would have a very hard time arguing, well, it's extreme to say this is a horrific system and we really need to rise up and get rid of this whole system and bring something radically different into being. But this is happening every year. The fact that they aren't literally doing it in the form of shooting them down one by one doesn't make it any less real that these children are being destroyed and killed and literally taken from their families and loved ones through starvation and preventable disease because of the workings of this system. When you begin to learn about all that, and at the same time as people are rising up to resist the forms of oppression and degradation that they can see around them or that they learn about in other parts of society, then there becomes more basis for people to be transformed, as we say. That's why we have the slogan, fight the power and transform the people for revolution. Because people, especially as they rise up and as they learn more about what the actual nature of this system is and the actual workings of it, what they really are and what the consequences of this are, then the idea that we need a radical alternative becomes something that people can turn to more, that people can recognize is a real and serious question that they should be getting into. I think this is the way, as Marx was saying, this belief in the permanent necessity of existing conditions begins to break down. And it's the interconnection and the back and forth between people fighting against outrages and crimes of the system that they can recognize and recognize as being outrageous and intolerable and that need to be resisted and fought against. And on the other hand, beginning to raise their heads to think about and to question seriously, could there be a radical alternative to this? And has there been any experience in history in which people have fought through and forged a radical alternative, even if it's been defeated and set back for the time being?
A quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
You know, it's extremely important the way you're approaching this, because there could be, you could easily fall into a thing of like, look, this is just the way things are. You look at the upheaval, whatever upheaval, as relatively small as it's been, that there's been in U.S. society, you know, there's been all these alternatives that people advance, like sustainable living, like fighting foreclosures or fighting this outrage or another, just in and of itself, or the various schemes that people have come up with in terms of trying to find an alternative lifestyle to this system. Because you could leave things at that and just declare there's no possibility, but you're digging into, actually, look, there's a system that's doing this, that there's these conditions, these things that are going to compel people to do more than anything that they might ever think that they would do. But it also requires this element of conscious revolutionary intervention in all this. And I was thinking about this in relation to where we live in the U.S. and the whole thing of, and the impact this has even on all the people that you've been talking about, the people in the base, the middle classes, the idea that this system for a lot of people has seemed almost, even when it's been at its low points in terms of what people recognize, it seems like it's almost invulnerable, that it bounces back and it continues to bounce back and it's still rolling along and crushing things down. And even people who see what they do there, and a lot of people just, we are kept so news blind in this society in terms of what is happening in the rest of the world, what is being done. And if it weren't for things like the radical literature that's out there, that if it weren't for things like Revolution Newspaper and other publications, that what you read in the press is just so distorted and wrong. But it also ties in with this point of people find ways to exist, even when they begin to see these things. People in the bottom, I've had a lot of people tell me they learned to live in, I remember one guy I met this summer in Brooklyn who told me, look, I've learned to live in the cut, okay? You know, and I don't like it, but I'm living there. And there's other people who find various ways to get into this. But I kept thinking about, there's a combination of the position of the U.S. in the world for a very long period of time and the impact that that has had on people's thinking. And then this whole mythology, the religion of democracy that's presented as, even as bad as it gets, still here, you have the possibility of casting your vote with others of like-minded, you know, like-mindedness, and standing up and possibly changing things that way. And it seems that that has a tremendous hold on people and really plays into this point about the weight of the permanent necessity of existing conditions.
Yeah, well, you know, look, I think a lot of it is people are either ignorant of, or some people are more willfully ignorant of, what is going on in the world, what their government, what this system, not just the government in and of itself, but the system this government enforces with its military and its institutions, like the IMF, which are in institutions of imperialist control, which are dominated by, above all, the U.S. You know, someone, I think, very correctly pointed out that instead of the IMF, instead of standing for the International Monetary Fund, should be called the Institute for Misery and Famine, because this is what it imposes, and this is why you have so many children dying in the third world, and why people are in such, or it's a big part of it, reinforcing the miserable conditions and worsening the miserable conditions in which people all over the third world in particular are entrapped and which they're forcibly maintained. So there's a lot of ignorance of that, but there's also some, let's face it, there's some willful ignorance of that, particularly on the part of people who do have access to information where they could learn about that. And you find people will actually say, well, you know, I don't want to go there. I don't want to find out about that because it's going to upset my, you know, it's going to challenge me in my comfort zone. It's going to upset my the way that I've accommodated to the way things are, including with, you know, with the belief that you were just saying that, well, maybe things are bad here, but at least we can vote. At least we can affect things. At least we have a democracy here, and so on and so forth. And, you know, and I was just thinking about, okay, there's what this country and the imperialist system does to people all over the world, particularly in the third world, which is on the level of what I'm talking about, and it's no less horrific than that. That's not any exaggeration or hyperbole. But I was also thinking recently, I was just looking at the latest issue of The New Yorker, which has an article about Questlove of the Roots, and he's talking about how he grew up in West Philadelphia, which when he first lived there, when his family first moved there, was a sort of a middle-class neighborhood, integrated neighborhood, and then was devastated in the decades following that. And he mentions, this is someone who sort of made it into the music world, you know, is not trapped in those conditions, but he says to the New Yorker person doing the article, look, I can think of 33 people that I grew up with. Out of those 33 people, myself and two others are the only people I know of who are not dead or in jail. And this is not some, you know, strange anomaly, some peculiarity that's, you know, that doesn't exist anywhere else. This is typical of the people growing up in the inner cities of this country right here, right around us, you know, maybe 2 miles from where some of your listeners might live, or 5 miles, you know. So what does that tell you about this country? And what has voting over the decades, on the part of people who might be appalled by this and think it's terrible, voting for Democrat after Democrat after Democrat, what has it done to change something like that? What has it done about the condition of women? What has it done about the fact that women's right to abortion and even to birth control is under increasing attack, and the Democrats are constantly backpedaling and conciliating over this, even while they might weekly at election time say a few words about how they uphold the right to it? You know, what has this done about war after war after war that this country has waged? What has voting for Democrats and voting in general done to change any of that for the better? All these conditions, like what Questlove is talking about, have gotten worse. You know, we have in this country over 2 million people, most of them Black and Latino, in prison. It's the highest rate of imprisonment in the entire world. We have the highest rate of women who are incarcerated in the entire world, and that number is rapidly growing. If this were happening in any other country, everybody would immediately recognize that this says something very fundamental about a whole country, that it incarcerates millions of people, and then when they get out of jail, they're put into a category of what amounts to second-class citizenship, once again legally discriminated against in all kinds of ways, including being banned from living in housing projects, having a stigma on them when they go to look for a job, having in many cases virtual impossibility of getting any kind of a decent job. If this were occurring in any other country, and people looked at that and the answer on the part of the people in that country were, yes, but we can vote, everybody would be outraged and say, what has your voting done to change any of that? And if your voting has done nothing to change any of all these things, then why do you keep talking about how important it is to be able to vote for the people, one group or the other, of the people who rule the society who are carrying out and enforcing all that?
A quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is an interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago.
But, you know, it's gotten fanatical to a certain extent. I mean, it really has. I mean, I was talking to a friend whose sister was one of the founders of SDS. And when he was trying to talk to her about, she was like campaigning for Obama. And when he was trying to talk to her about what was going on, she was making a big argument about voting. And then he said, but listen to what you're voting for. Let's just talk about what has been done. And she literally, almost literally, she said, I don't want to hear you. It was almost like the little kids do about sticking their hands in her ears and thumbs in her ears. I can't hear you. You know, that's what it was like.
Yeah.
You know, and you think about this, and people, and I was telling you a little earlier about the way the disgusting chauvinism that even got wrapped up in this whole question of, you've got to vote, you've got to vote. There's this element that you've talked about before about the kind of the shill that's being operated there in terms of voting and what does it do and what does it change. But there's also this, there's a complicity that
right.
gets wrapped up in this. And you know, I've heard people talk about if you vote, you get to decide where the bombs are going to be dropped, or even, and equally bad, and in some ways even worse, the question of, if you vote, you're not only voting for the president of the United States, but you're voting for the president of the world.
Yeah, I mean, look what people are being turned into and reduced to. You know, to say that you want to be part of deciding where the bombs are going to be dropped. I don't want to be part of that. Why would any decent person want to be part of deciding where... First of all, it's an illusion. You don't even get to be part of deciding that anyway, just for the record. But why would you even want to be part of that? Why would you want to be part of deciding whom you know, your government is going to obliterate, you know, and how many children and other people are going to be blown apart by the bombs of your government? It's sick. Nothing less than sick to actually want to be part of that, even though it's an illusion that you are part of it. And that's the point, is beyond what I was just saying about it, what good has it done? It has done no good to vote for these Democrats. You're just voting for people who are vying one party against the other to carry out war crimes and crimes against humanity around the world as well as in this country. That's what you're voting for. But it's not only that it has never done any good about these basic things that keep happening and even getting worse. It's even worse than that. You are, as you were just speaking to, you are becoming complicit in these crimes. You are being called upon, and you are willingly, whether you're consciously doing it or not, you are willingly becoming part of a process where you are giving an endorsement to and allowing the people who actually decide these things and who actually rule things to say that they have a popular mandate to do them because you voted for them, or a lot of people voted for them. The first step that a people who want a different world and a better world, one of the first great steps they could take was just to stop voting for representatives of this system that enforce all the horrors of the current world. And just think, if you want to think about political effect, think of what the political effect would be in this country and throughout the world if, let's say, 50 million people refused to vote and openly declared, I'm not voting for the representatives of this system because all they're doing is competing over rival strategies about how to enforce the oppressive interests of a system that creates, maintains, and enforces horrific conditions for masses of people all over the world and is committed and carries out war crimes and crimes against humanity on a world-class level. Imagine if tens of millions of people said, we are not voting for the one or the other competing group to carry that out. Imagine how much more powerful a political effect that would be. Just that act, it's not enough. We need a revolution. We can talk about that. Let's be clear, that in itself would not be enough. But what a great step that would be in terms of delivering a rebuke to the people who are vying to carry out these crimes, and a statement to the whole world that the people of this country, instead of being drawn into a process of giving their stamp of approval to this, are standing up and openly repudiating it. So I'm not calling for a boycott as a, you know, a political tactic. I'm just making a statement that it would be far better if people did that rather than getting drawn once again into giving their endorsement and the appearance of a popular mandate to all these crimes. And you can see by what you were just referring to how perverse this is becoming, how chauvinistic and jingoistic people are getting when they say you're voting for the president of the world. I mean, first of all, just think about that statement. What kind of democracy is that when you're saying that that whom you're electing here is going to be the ruler of the world, but most people in the world don't get to vote on it? Even on that paltry level, it's ridiculous, and worse than ridiculous, it's tremendously chauvinistic. But worse than that, you know, the idea that we should want to vote to decide how American imperial rule is going to be imposed over people in the world, and where, as you were just saying, something as disgusting as where the bomb should be dropped. We should want to be part of, have a voice in that. As I said, it's an illusion. You don't get to be really have any voice in that anyway. They don't come and consult you. They just do it. They didn't have a popular referendum to decide whether they should bomb Libya or not. They just did it, you know, and you didn't have a voice in it at all. And most people, if they're honest, who voted for Obama the first time around, didn't vote for Obama to drop bombs on Libya. They thought they were voting for somebody who, or at least many people did, who wouldn't do something like that. But now things that people have been dragged down so far by being chained within this way of, not only this process, but the narrow confines of thinking in this way, that at least, as you're saying, some people have gotten to the point, the miserable point of actually saying, well, you know, we might be able to decide what country our big bad imperial, you know, system devastates with our bombs.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show and the interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while back. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll rejoin our conversation with Bob Avakian. Welcome back. That was Naked Truth from Hamid Drake, Albert Baker, and William Parker. Now let's rejoin the interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
Now, one thing, though, that has come up often in relation to this, and particularly, I mean, it's interesting. It became, I think, partly because of the character of the election this time around, and the fact that, I mean, look, they did a whole big thing with this election where my take on it was really that there was, leading up to that first debate, there was this whole point, there was this real disenchantment, there was a real kind of, you know, and I think, you know, you were referring to it before, that the feeling that was a lot of, it was a very down election, you know, in terms of people were kind of, what can I do? But there was still, this sanctity of voting was still there. And they were going to go out and do this, but after that first debate, and I often wonder whether that first debate was actually staged the way it was, because it suddenly became a horse race. It really became a horse race after that, you know, with Biden getting out. Oh, he's the boxer, and he's but then all this stuff came up, where you have this, okay, it's a big horse race, and then even to get people who might still be sort of, well, I'm not so sure, they're not talking about foreign policy, they're not talking about this. They cast this thing in many ways in terms of race. And, you know, Romney and the racists and the fascists on one side, Obama, and representing the people on the other side. And particularly, there's the question of that and how that was cast. And then there's the question of the appeal to progressive people and to black people in particular about voting and how important voting is, you know, in the way they're portraying it, to the lives of black people, and the fact that so many black people not only fought for this, but gave their lives for the right to vote. And here you have an election again where, you know, the irregularities and the voter suppression and all these things were being, that the threat to take that right to vote away drew a lot of people into saying, I may not even believe in all this stuff, but damn it, I am not going to stand back and throw a vote away when so many people died for it.
Well, there are different elements of what you just mentioned. First of all, I think it's true that in 2008, they were able to create all, after 8 years of W. Bush, you know, they were able to create this whole illusory notion that Obama represented some kind of big change and hope, you know, hope, change, these were the watchwords. And of course, people were writing their own illusions into the persona of Obama. They were filling up the persona of Obama with their own illusions about what they wanted Obama to be. And they were encouraged to do that. Obama even commented on the fact that people were doing this. That's how cynical some of this stuff is. But people were doing that. There was much more a positive enthusiasm for Obama going into the 2008 election, because people are still trapped within the confines of thinking that if there's something horrible like what was happening under the, you know, regime of George W. Bush, the only possible alternative that's realistic is to vote for other representatives of the ruling class and the imperialist system in the Democratic Party. But this time around, there wasn't the same sort of enthusiasm. There had been a lot of disaffection, a lot of disillusionment with Obama. You know, I'm going to close down Guantanamo. I'm going to close it down within the first year. It's still there 4 years later. You know, this is not a country that should torture. But he never could find it to actually prosecute the people who openly tortured, while he goes after people like Bradley Manning and Assange and people who've blown the whistle on crimes of the U.S. government. All these promises were betrayed time and time again by Obama. A lot of the hope, the illusion of change you can believe in, was shattered. So there wasn't the same enthusiasm. But then two things do converge. One, the idea that somehow if you don't take part in this electoral process, then you're missing out on having an influence on things. When in fact, as he said, what you're just being drawn into is a process that's entirely on the terms of the system and the ruling class that presides over and enforces that system. And you're just being drawn into being complicit in the form of giving your endorsement to whatever the government then proceeds to do after the election. But there was that illusion. You just can't not be part. You can't stand aside from the process of choosing, even though choosing actually means endorsing all these crimes and horrors. But there was also what became more and more front and center was, once again, the shadow and the terrible specter of what is represented by the Republicans, who are, like, openly horrific. They'll openly say that they want to get rid of the right to abortion, whereas the Democrats rather just compromise it away slowly and allow more and more attacks to mount, not only on abortion, but on birth control all over the country, and who obviously cannot be relied upon not to just give away the whole right to abortion in reaching across the aisle once again to make compromises with the Republicans. But at least, you know, they don't openly call for doing away with it. The Republicans openly embrace racism and time after time have racists pop up and make these outrageous fascistic comments about black people, or just generally Nazi-like comments about the kind of society that we should have, you know, and openly promote ignorance and philistinism, denying the scientific fact of evolution, on and on. So then this specter gets raised. Do you want this? So maybe you're disappointed and disillusioned with Obama, but you certainly don't want that. They knew going into this election, the Democratic Party operatives and that section of the ruling class that they more or less represent, knew that they couldn't fire the same kind of enthusiasm they had in 2008. So they played up that angle of, once again, you know, you have to vote. It's your chance to influence things. But more than that, look at this specter of what you'll get if you don't vote. You're going to allow the Republicans to get in. And of course, if you do vote for the Democrats and they continue to have the presidency and the Senate or whatever, then they're going to do the same kind of things are going to keep happening, where things move further and further in a bad direction. And what the Democrats said yesterday they would not do, they do tomorrow, and that becomes the new norm, and then so on and so on, and this process continues. But somehow the specter of the Republicans is enough to scare many people into voting for the Democrats, because once again, it goes back to the first point we started with. People have lost the sense, or their sights have been so lowered that they can't even imagine any kind of positive alternative that doesn't get funneled once again back into this electoral process of choosing between these different groups representing the same system. And, you know, look back at, for example, the 2008 election, how many people who presented themselves as progressive or part of the left or whatever were saying we have to vote for the Democrats, we have to vote for Obama, but once he gets in there, then we're going to go out into the streets and we're going to, you know, there were different illusory notions about what it meant. Well, we're going to make him do what he wants, really wants to do, but can't do without mass pressure. Or we're going to recognize that when Obama gets in, he's going to do all kinds of terrible things that he said he wouldn't do, but we're going to be right there to oppose that and take to the streets and keep him from doing that, make him go on the direction that he promised he would go in. How many people, let's be honest, how many people who said all that in 2008 really carried through and acted on it? I can think of a couple. And maybe there are a few more. But overwhelmingly, what you see, the real phenomenon, is that almost all the people who said that did nothing as Obama carried out crime after crime with the drones, with his firm backing for Israel, including in its threats for war against Iran, while people, you know, among black people were being once again fed into this endless pipeline off to prison, while masses of women in housing projects, it's never even talked about, have been evicted in huge numbers out of these housing projects, while the conditions of the masses of black people have gotten worse and worse, while immigrants have been deported by Obama in record numbers. Yes, he set a record for deporting immigrants, despite his latest little maneuver of, well, some people won't be deported. All this has been going on. Where are all those people who said, well, we'll vote for Obama, we got to vote for Obama to keep the Republicans out in 2008, but we'll be out on the streets fighting all these things? Where are they? Why haven't they been out in the streets? Because they've been caught up in the logic that the only thing that matters is to make the choices that the system gives you. And even in the logic of we mustn't do anything to unsettle things, if we go out in the streets, then that might help the Republicans, because then they'll be able to point to the fact that the people who are supporting Obama are disrupting things and causing all kinds of turmoil, and that'll undercut Obama's chances to get reelected. So this is the logic you get caught up in when you can't see beyond this extremely narrow, constraining and repressive framework of looking only in the confines of this system. And then there is a reality of what you were mentioning about black people. Yes, black, one of the main focuses and fronts of struggle of the civil rights movement back in the 50s and 60s was to win the right to vote. One of the main forms in which black people were oppressed, besides the open segregation, besides the sharecropping exploitation, besides the terror of the Ku Klux Klan, going along with all that, but one of the key forms was being denied the right to vote. And people did sacrifice and, yes, give their lives to win that right. And today we see there are moves, including by the Republicans, who have, you know, become, in the way the dynamics of electoral politics have gone, have become basically the white people's party in this country. Not that all white people vote for them or support them, but that's, you know, they've more or less given up, particularly on black people, but even to a large degree in these recent elections, they've written off large sections of Latinos and people concerned about immigration and so on. So they become a sort of a white party and a white supremacist party. And as part of that, they have taken moves toward restricting or keeping, reinforce them to vote. Of course, that should be fought, because that's another form of trying to reinforce the oppression of black people, which is already so terrible in this country, and so with such horrific consequences. But it's one thing to fight for the right to vote and fight against attempts to take away the right to vote, recognizing that this is one of the main ways in which the oppression of black people is being carried out. It's another thing to say, because we have the right and had to fight for the right, we should use it, even if using it is against our own interests. And that, in fact, is the case. Being caught up in the emotions around this, rather than looking at it and saying, well, where do our real interests lie, is harmful to people. People need to be rising above simply the terms of, should we have the right to vote or should we not? Of course, people should have the right to vote and should fight against it being taken away. But then the bigger question, the more fundamental question is, what does voting actually involve and what does it mean? Whose interests does it really serve? Does it really serve the interests of black people to vote time and again for the Democrats, only to have the Democrats preside over more oppression of black people. And this whole idea that, for example, Obama was going to bring improvement for black people was completely wrong in the first place and has been proven to be wrong. I mean, Obama has continues to preside over a government which arrests masses of black youth in record numbers, not only in the history of this country, but in the world, and enforces all kinds of other horrendous conditions in which these youth and the masses of black people more broadly, as well as other sections of oppressed people in this society, are enchained. And the whole idea that Obama would somehow uplift the masses of black people, inspire the youth to better things, ran right up against the reality, which was a very coldly calculated reality, that the real purpose in regard to black people, or one of the main purposes of having the first African-American president in the person of Obama, would be to say, now you have no more excuses. If you are in terrible conditions, if you don't have any employment, if all the jobs, any decent jobs, have been taken away and moved out of any area where you'd get them, if you have no decent medical care, if you have no decent education, if you have no prospects for the future, if, as even a conservative commentator, Edward Luckbach, said in his book, Turbo Capitalism, if you're a youth in the inner cities, for many of those youth, given the actual prospects they have, crime is a rational choice. If you're in that situation and you decide to go into crime because there's nothing else for you, it's your own fault, because now we have a black president, so it proves that anybody, as Obama said in his last speech, his victory speech after the recent election, if you work hard, and by implication, play by the rules, but if you work hard, he said directly, then no matter who you are, you can make it in America. That's a slap in the face of all the people who are not, quote-unquote, making it, who are having a harder and harder time, or in the case of black people, who have never been allowed to, quote-unquote, make it under this system, and whose conditions have only gotten worse. And the whole ruling class has used the fact that you have the first African-American president to say, now there can be no more excuses. So if you are in these conditions and you have no way out, it's your own fault. And I could say that in more strong words, but we're on the radio and there's the FCC and all the rest of it. So I'll just say, it's your own fault. You have no more excuses. And Obama has directly lent himself to that. Right after his first election, he went and gave his Father's Day speech, where he chastised the masses of black youth and black people for not taking responsibility for lifting themselves up, the old bootstraps thing, once again. And then he openly called on the black youth to pull their pants up. And I point out to people, where did this whole culture of low sagging pants even come from? It comes from the prisons where people are not even allowed to have belts. And then think about, what does it mean that among the black youth, something that comes from the prisons is a cultural norm? What does that say about what's happening to these youth with the stop and frisk that goes on in New York, where people in the hundreds of thousands, overwhelmingly black and Latino, are ridden up on by the police and humiliated and degraded and forced into these submissive positions and even brutalized when they're doing absolutely nothing wrong in the overwhelming majority of cases? What does it mean when sagging pants because of no belt coming out of the prisons has become a cultural norm? What does it say about the conditions, not that people have chosen for themselves, but to which they're subjected? Here comes Obama. Instead of saying this is an outrage that all of the black youth are being subjected to these conditions and given no decent options so that many of them are turning to crime, we have to stop this mass incarceration. We have to stop this police murder of youth in the inner cities in the hundreds every year. We have to stop this mass brutality that goes on every day. We have to stop this degradation that is enforced by all this. Instead of saying any of that, Obama says, pull up your pants. Now, here's a question. Let's say that all the black youth all across the country listened to Obama and all pulled up their pants the day after he gave this Father's Day speech. Would they all have much improved lives the next day? Would they all suddenly have jobs? Would the police all of a sudden stop harassing and brutalizing and even murdering them? Would they all have decent education and decent health care? I'm not going to insult your listeners by thinking they don't know the answer to that.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and that was an interview I did with him a little while ago. And that interview, to remind you again, it's going to be aired in 5 parts. Today was the first segment, and now for the next 4 weeks, or the next 4 shows after this one, there'll be a new segment, usually about a half an hour long, in each of those shows. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss any of this. But if you do happen to miss one segment of this interview, you can access all the segments that have been broadcast thus far, and in the end, all of them, at revcom.us. Now, I should also let you know that this interview is part of a series of new works by Bob Avakian. And in these works, Avakian speaks the sharp and deep truths that this system is working overtime to keep hidden. And I should tell you, these works include, in addition to this interview that I did with Bob Avakian, they also include Cornel West's interview with Avakian that was conducted in 2012 and aired on PRI's Smiley and West show. And they include also an extensive interview conducted by a younger generation revolutionary, Abe Brooks. And that interview was called What Humanity Needs, Revolution and the New Synthesis of Communism. And in February of 2013, there's a film of a new 6.5-hour talk given in the fall of 2012, and that's scheduled to be released again in February of 2013. And you can access all of these works at revcom.us. Again, that's revcom.us. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Deborah Sweet, the national director of the World Can't Wait, and she's going to give us a report straight from the streets of Washington, D.C., about the demonstration demanding that Guantanamo prison chamber be closed now. So stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and it's the Michael Slate Show. And we're now going to be talking with Deborah Sweet, the national director of The World Can't Wait. And Deborah is in Washington, D.C., as part of the demonstration demanding the closing of the Guantanamo prison torture chamber. And not just saying, close it, please, saying, we demand it get closed now. No excuses, shut it down. Deborah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Michael. I have to admit, I'm a bit overwhelmed and choked up. I'm sorry I missed most of your show. We were marching from the Supreme Court past all the institutions that are responsible for this immoral, illegitimate, unjust prison and for what the U.S. has done with it. We started at the Supreme Court. We marched then past the U.S. District Court, which is probably even more responsible for decisions on, in the cases of individual prisoners. Over and over and over again, even when there's no evidence against them, even when they're due habeas corpus proceedings, this court has judged in its full panel to deny the prisoners the rights to leave. Then we marched by the FBI. Now we're down at the White House. There's several hundred of us. And as usual, and this is strange to say it's usual, but people march in orange jumpsuits with black hoods, single file, in a silent procession by all these institutions. And I've done this myself several times with the hood on. This time, I didn't do that, but I was observing and chanting and talking to people. On the subject of why, you know, this is 11 years, why we are out here doing this, and what is the significance, and why we at least, these several hundred of us, and then people in Los Angeles, Chicago, and around the country, are not afraid to open our eyes to this reality. And I think it's my case, in my case, that's because I know it doesn't have to be this way. This is not permanent. It can't be allowed to be permanent. It's got to be changed by a population who just says we will not tolerate this being done in our name.
You know, Deborah, there's a big question here too. As you're saying that, I think it's extremely important. I want to just dig into that a little bit more, because over the past, you know, couple of months, we've seen things, you know, where there's this whole thing about people thought, okay, Obama promised to close Guantanamo, da 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 da, all this other stuff. But everything that's been done seems to have been, this is just going to be, you know, funneled and fine-tuned and continue on if they if they're able to do what they want to do. For instance, the idea that, you know, everybody talks about secret trials and, you know, the past experience in socialism, secret trials, all this stuff. Here we have what's going on in these military tribunals are as close to secret trials that you can get. I mean, they even have white noise, blocking out any testimony that people might have about the possibility of what happened to them when they were interrogated and tortured. You have also the idea, the NDAA that was just signed in, which seemed to say there's no way in hell that they're going to be, that they intend to or they would be able to close Guantanamo now.
Well, exactly so. I mean, this is outrageous. It's probably the most totalitarian situation you could have because it's carried out under the cover of so-called democracy and openness, when in fact there's no truth at all told about why these men were being held in the first place, what they may have done or not done, and there's no access that the defendants have to learn even what they're being charged with in many cases. And then there's the issue that Andy Worthington talked about on your show a couple of weeks ago, and that is that the majority of the prisoners being held right now have been cleared for release in most cases back under the Bush years. So you have people, as we heard today, who have spent more than a third and sometimes almost half of their lives in this prison with no prospects ever of being released. This indefinite detention, the targeted kill list, is a question of contention here. People are arguing, well, Obama really wants to close Guantanamo. It's for Congress. You know what? They're all of a piece. Obama is the commander-in-chief of a rapacious imperialist empire, and he has no intentions, as far as I can see, to close Guantanamo, because that would open up further investigation as to the torture and the so-called enhanced interrogation methods that are, so movingly dramatized in Zero Dark Thirty. And so they want this squashed down. So it takes nothing at all will change this other than a movement of conscious people. You know, starting with a core of people who really know that this can be different. And you know, Bob Avakian, as I was listening, was talking about the mass incarceration. And here we are talking about mass incarceration by our government around the world, not just in this country. And this all has to be changed. We have to get people in this country thinking about it in an entirely different context as unjust and unacceptable. And then there's the hope that these wars can be stopped and that there is the potential of stopping this indefinite detention all over the world done by the United States.
You know, that's an important point you're raising around this. In a way, Guantanamo, which is extremely important because it is, I mean, it's the 10th anniversary, and it sort of sits there as the forefront, as the concentration of everything that this system, that this country is about in the world today. But it's also, in a way, it's a gateway. If you think about the kinds of things that have happened to people and where, you know, they just revealed last week, the Washington Post had an article that where they discovered that, oh, Obama is still carrying out renditioning, you know, in Africa and other places. And this is Guantanamo actually opens a gateway to that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's all the men that got into Guantanamo were kidnapped in the first place. Many were rendered. Many went through Guantanamo. And if you're not going to find that to be illegitimate, much less hold anyone accountable for this, prosecution or even investigation, then this happens as part of the secrets that democracy carries out to keep its empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we need more, courageous exposures. But, you know, most of all, I would say we need to have hundreds of thousands and then millions of people protesting against these completely unjust, immoral, illegitimate wars, the indefinite detention, and the whole package that goes with it.
Well, Deborah, we have about 2 minutes, so let's get into that. What's the plan for actually bringing that about?
Well, you know, this is... We've been talking in the last 24 hours, all the Guantanamo attorneys, the activists that arrive, and we say, you know, this is so strange. We see all these people we love and respect and depend on coming together once a year at this terrible anniversary. And a lot of the folks that I'm talking about had a great deal of hope in Obama. I would say almost everybody that I count part of this group thought I was a little wrong when I said in 2008, this is going to go nowhere good when Obama comes in. And now people are confronting the situation that here we have a second term and things are even more tightened down. Obama just signed the extension of the FISA law, unjust surveillance. He just signed the new NDAA for 2013, just as bad as 2012. And he's made several rulings via the Justice Department that these individual Guantanamo prisoners aren't going to get any justice, so you can't have faith there. Again, I'm glad that people in Los Angeles and Chicago and Seattle are doing things around the country today, especially as the film that we talked about a month ago, Zero Dark Thirty, is suddenly coming under some criticism and fire from people besides those of us that when it came out early. And I think this is a really a flashpoint politically for people to view it, debate it, discuss it. And then I hope at the Oscars, there's going to be a hell of a protest against any potential that this film Zero Dark Thirty, which justifies torture and so-called enhanced interrogation, wins the Best Picture Award.
All right, Deborah, we're going to have to wrap it up now, but I would encourage people to go to World Can't Wait's website. World Can't Wait, is it .org?
It's .org or .net.
Okay. WorldCan'tWait.org or .net, and check out Deborah's reporting on today and on the continuing reporting around these issues. Deborah, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay, talk to you again soon. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Deborah Sweet, the National Director of the World Can't Wait organization, and she's been giving us a live report from the streets of Washington, D.C., and the demonstration at the 10th anniversary of the Guantanamo torture chamber and the demonstration that's demanding to shut it down now. I want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And you can follow me on Twitter or Facebook. We're going to go out now with Future Rock from Outer National.
This is Future Rock! Shut up!